truth is stranger than fiction. This is the proof. This is Ripley's. Believe it or not. Bedrooms in the cantons of Grisons, Switzerland have tiny windows opened when the occupant is dying, so his soul can escape, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about cows who grow their own gold teeth. Not to be confused with the goose who laid the golden eggs, were the cows in the state of Washington who actually grew gold teeth. Amazing, but a matter of fact, these bovines grazed in the Alder Creek Basin near a famous gold mine, and as they chewed, they picked up gold dust embedded in the ground. The chemical combination of lime in the cow's teeth and the gold dust created a perfect and permanent and valuable gold dental crown. Believe it or not.
I'm Monster B, and welcome to Tip Radio, episode 11, for October 17th, 2009. If you're a first-time listener, this is a potluck roundtable series on Hacker Public Radio. And I just want to let everybody know, Tip Radio also has an OGG feed. Just navigate your browser to tipradio.info, and underneath the cow logo, click on Feed Bag. Okay, let's meet tonight's roundtable. Klaatu.
Hello, everyone.
Peter 64.
G'day.
Azimuth.
Good evening, Monster B.
J-Man.
Hello.
330.
Howdy, howdy.
And Pegwall.
Hey.
And I just got a quick announcement here. World of Goo has turned 1 year old, and to celebrate, 2D Boy has a special offer. Until October 19th, which is Monday, you can get the game for any price you want. You just go over to the website and click on buy, and if you want to like pay them a penny, a dollar, $5, whatever, $20, you can get the game. And it's only good until Monday, so this is only good for our OGG listeners and our live listeners, because by the time people in HPR hear this, it's going to be expired.
That's a great game, too. I've played it on a friend's computer. It's really fun.
I think I'm going to go ahead and buy it for $10. That seems fair, doesn't it? It's a year old.
Yeah, and it's like native Linux support, which is pretty cool.
Does it work on 64-bit?
Ooh, good question. That's a very good question. I'll probably buy it anyway, just to have it around. I could at least play it on my EEE PC or something.
All right, how about that feedback, Klaatu? We got one, didn't we?
Yeah, we did, actually. It's from 5150. That's the person's email handle. And they say that Klaatu inquired as to the profit incentive for the ViewCat, which, this is me, just, it was that Radio Shack thing that people were telling me about a couple episodes ago, some kind of scanner that they were giving out at Radio Shack. And 5150 says, it wasn't so much to look up product pages using the item barcode. I think that was an afterthought and only worked for participating advertisers. Advertisers and publishers, Parade Magazine was a big one, would include a barcode at the bottom of an ad or article in place of or in conjunction with the "to learn more, go to this URL" tag. Advertisers had discovered many of their customers were simply incapable of reading a URL and typing it into the address bar of their browser. So ViewCat was just a way to connect web pages to the print media. Today I still have customers who can't load a web page unless it is linked to whatever homepage the system came with. I tried and never did find a way to use mine as a generic barcode scanner. I know it's still somewhere at the bottom of my closet. Next time I uncover it, I'll find out if Linux recognizes it. That's the email. about ViewCat. Fascinating information.
Well, I just remember when I had that thing, I could scan anything in the cupboard or anything that had a barcode, and it would, you know, a web page would fire up.
Ah, okay. I don't really know that much about barcodes. I don't know how much information you can store in a barcode. So possibly they started associating websites with more barcodes than maybe advertised, or that scanner was just translating anything into some random website. Was it a pretty random website, do you remember, or was it something actually connected to what you'd scan?
It was connected to what you would scan. I mean, if you scanned a Mountain Dew can,
yeah,
it would take you to the Mountain Dew website.
Okay. Yeah, maybe they're just packing more information into those things than people realize. Either way, it's a weird idea, I think, but I can see how, yeah, literally some people just can't seem to navigate their web browser, so they would need, like, some hardware interface for that. I've seen people struggle with that URL bar before.
All right. Thanks for that feedback, and Kautu, thanks for reading it. And what's your story for today, or topic?
Boot.kernel.org. It's a very, very cool little project. Obviously something, I don't know, sponsored by or under the wing of kernel.org, which is the page where we all get our Linux kernel from, one way or another. And boot.kernel.org is a project to make, from what I can gather, it's to make Pixie booting just really, really simple. Because basically all you do is download an image file of boot.kernel.org, like their little, I guess they're calling it BKO. And I think it's like, I could be wrong, but I mean, it's a tiny, tiny little download that you have to do. And then you can boot a computer using this boot file. And it will essentially boot, you know, as long as you know what network you are able to boot to, it will boot via the interwebs to some kind of live environment where you can actually either install Linux from or maybe diagnose things from or whatever, just depending. Right now they've got like a Debian environment, Ubuntu, Damn Small Linux, Canopix, and Fedora 11.
So is it a full desktop or just a shell that you boot into?
Actually a full desktop. Well, it depends. Like I know that Fedora 11, it says it's just single user mode, and I think it's just a shell. But like Damn Small Linux, you actually get the full desktop that you boot to. So it just depends on which one you're choosing, and presumably which like, because you can also use the little, I guess it's called GPXE. You can use that also to just boot into any, I guess, Pixie boot environment. So if you know the address of the Debian, you know, net install server, you can just use GPXE to boot there. But in terms of what they're doing at boot.kernel.org, yeah, you actually do get a full desktop in some instances.
Okay, this is pretty neat. So you can put it on a CD or USB.
Yeah.
That's cool. Or a floppy.
Right.
If people still use them.
Apparently, yes.
So this image you download, it has all this on there. It has Debian, Ubuntu, Damn Small Linux, Canopix, and Fedora all in one image? Or do you have to go out and download all that stuff separate?
Well, it's on the server, if I'm not mistaken. All you're doing is downloading the shell to enable you to boot, you know, via a network. And you can go into whatever server with these live environments on it that you choose.
So these are remote servers that they're supplying you, or supplying the person using it? Or do you put it on your own server somewhere?
No, they are supplying. The server is remote, unless, of course, you want to put it on your own, in which case you can do that. But then I guess you don't technically need this necessarily if you've got your own Pixie server. I mean, at least the Toshiba that I recently acquired has something where, you know, in the BIOS you can set, okay, look at the network card to see if there's a local environment to boot from. So I wouldn't need this. But if you want to be able to boot off of some remote, you know, server with a live environment on it, you know, off in Washington University or something, you could do that with this GPXE. It's like a 220 kilobyte download. I mean, it's nothing. It's just, from what I can tell, it's basically a really kind of fancy bootloader.
Well, it sounds pretty neat, but I'm trying to understand what it's for. You know, what is it, just really to try out things?
I think it would be more of like a diagnosis tool and also probably an installation tool as well.
Pretty neat.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool because this kind of flexibility, I mean, I don't know. If you can look at a project and say, well, yeah, so, you know, what would I use this for? I mean, that means you've by now gotten so many options in Linux and the way that you can install it or use it on a computer that you're literally running out of things to do with all your options. And, I mean, that's a good thing. That means that we've got a lot of options. And that's not something that every OS, I think, really has that many ways to boot, you know, your computer into that OS. I mean, Linux just, I mean, there's just practically anything you have. You can, you know, if you've got a little bit of know-how, you can boot the thing into Linux one way or another. That's a good thing. Not that it's something you'll need every day of your life, but the one time you need it, you're going to love that it's there.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try it out just to fully understand.
Yeah, I'm going to try it out pretty soon here.
All right, cool. Anything else on this one?
Nope, that's it. Just something I came across and thought was really cool.
Nice find. And how about you, Peter64?
Yeah, I haven't really done much this week. One thing I did want to have a play with was GNOME 3. Now, running Arch, it's been in the AUR, where you can use the Git build, I think it is, and pull it down. And I decided to install it on the laptop and have a play with it. But doing it through Arch and AUR took me bloody half a day because you have to go through and... Well, I had to edit quite a few of the pack builds to get it to work, had to read a fair bit of documentation. And when I finally did get it running, it was very slow on the laptop. But I think that's because, for some reason, under Arch, the Intel drivers aren't working particularly well. I think, Cloud2, you mentioned that that could be the version, because I was running the 2.9. I did go back to the 2.7, and it did make... slightly better, but typically it was nowhere as good as under Zeus. But anyway, with GNOME 3, I was talking to the J-Man, and he pointed out that one of the best ways to sort of install it and have a look, and when we're talking GNOME 3, we're talking just the shell, which I understand that, what's that mean, Jaylin? It doesn't actually have any or of the applications that you can expect? Or?
Yeah, the way they have it laid out is, with 2.28, most distros will have the shell in the repos, and you can just run that on top of 2.28. But really, once they get going, you know, they have to add in support for their Zeitgeist searching, and they have geolocation libraries and all that stuff.
Yeah, what I can understand, or what I'm not totally sure this is right, but we should see it first in Ubuntu 10.04 and Fedora 13, from what I've been able to read. But anyway, the simplest way to install it, and I hadn't heard of this, and I was talking to a few blokes actually in the IRC channel, and they hadn't come across it either, is that JH build, J. Lindsay, that you pointed out. So if you go over to live.gnome.org/JH build, and really, if you follow the instructions on the page, it's a matter of, I think, about four steps. One thing's very important, though, if you want to try this out, you have to get rid of the GStreamer bad plugin. And trust me, if you don't, you won't get this thing built. And if you're doing it through the Arch AUR, you have to remove that too. There's obviously some problem there they've got to fix. Now, I understand that I'm not a GNOME user. In actual fact, I don't think I've ever used the... Don't get over to live.gnome.org, JH build. Go over to live.gnome.org/G. GNOME shell, it is where you'll find the simple instructions on how to do it. Anyway, understand I'm not a GNOME user, but I just wanted to have a look at it. And after playing around with it for probably 15, 20 minutes, I must say, people who have left GNOME, and from what I understand there's quite a few, gone over to KDE 4, purely, I'd say a lot of that's to do with all the eye candy that KDE 4 offers, I see a lot of people going back. Now, that's only my personal opinion because looks-wise, it's pretty. Now, usability-wise, it depends. Yeah.
Sorry. Are there any screenshots anywhere, like, online that we can see the beauty that is GNOME 3?
Yeah, I think if you just go to that livegnome.org, GNOME shell on the right-hand side, I think it might point them out, does it?
Okay, cool. I'll check
somewhere around there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually got it halfway down that page. You'll see screenshots.
Cool, okay.
Current status. But anyway, one thing I found a little bit disconcerting, when you go up the top, you have your taskbar, and on the left-hand side, it has activities, which is typically like, you know, your KDE start menu. When you click on that, it goes into this overview mode, which is where I think in KDE Glatu, they might call it sort of, it's like that mosaic when all your applications become small.
Yeah.
Sort of icons, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
On the desktop. So, yeah, so if you've got four desktops, workspaces, and then you move up to your activities, it goes into this mosaic look, or what did I call it before?
Exposé, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for, exposé.
Yep.
Yeah. It goes into this overview mode. Now, I didn't
Although
get
that.
That
is a trademarked term by Apple.
Oh, is it? Okay, yeah. But people understand. Yeah, like I said, it's a little bit disconcerting at first, and after playing with it 15, 20 minutes, I still wasn't used to it. Every time I went up to these activities, all the desktops appeared, and I got this menu down the left-hand side. But give it a while, and I think it would certainly grow on you. But the first impressions, I think it has moved GNOME into the 21st century, because I always thought GNOME is a little bit older-looking, and honestly not particularly impressive. But once again, I never used it that much anyway. Also, I've read a lot of things like, they say that, you know, it's going to improve your workflow and the usability of your whole GUI. Now, yeah, that could be the case, because when you go into this overview mode, it's quite easy to drag applications from one workspace to the other. However, if you've been used to Fluxbox or something and you know, you set up your keys file to simply hit keys and send applications to workspaces, well, I really don't see that as a usability improvement, but maybe for GNOME it is. Taylor, what do you reckon? You've been running for quite some time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to like it and some won't, but for the most part, it's pretty nice as an upgrade.
Yeah, iCandy-wise, it's certainly, well, from what I've seen of GNOME, and I hadn't seen GNOME for quite some time, it's a hell of an improvement. I mean, obviously, I think people know that I'm a Fluxbox man. I can't see myself changing. But if I was a KDE user, I think I could quite happily get used to GNOME pretty quickly, that's for sure. Dare say we'll talk about it again later on when it gets a bit more established. But certainly, anyway, they're the links going. It's very easy to build with that JH build.
Yeah, it seems pretty cool. Trying to figure out if you're right about the whole people switching away from GNOME running to KDE. I thought it's kind of the inverse, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. I seem to think a lot of... Well, I would, if I was a KDE user, I would purely move to GNOME 3 just to get away from whatever 330's using. So he's going over to KDE. I'm going the other way. Yeah, so, Clatu, you think a lot of people left KDE when it went to 4 over to GNOME?
Famously, Linus Torvalds did, and then Larry Bushy from Going Linux did, I know. I don't know. My impression was that some people were jumping ship. I never heard anyone say it the other way. One person went the other way.
Yeah, I thought originally a lot of people, when it was just 4, a lot of people didn't like it. Although,
yeah.
What's Sergi, what's his name, the KDE 4 bloke?
Aaron Saigo.
He said that 4 is not for the average user. He went to great depths to say that. I remember him saying that on Tilts, that, you know, 4.0 is not going to be for the average user and all this sort of stuff. And people still complained about it, even after they're told. That's what amazed me.
Well, I guess that's the other question then. I mean, when is GNOME 3.0, you know, when is that, there's this whole desire, I guess, within open source to release early release often, but I imagine they're going to try to avoid a KDE 4-like backlash, so I wonder what they're going to be doing about that.
I actually did read something of that somewhere, but I can't even remember what they said. But in saying that, challenging, the switch from GNOME, what's out at the moment? Is it 2.28 or 2.26? What's the actual one?
Yeah, the new release is 2.28.
Yeah, so the release, the jump from 2.28 to 3 is going to be nowhere near as big as where 3.5 to 4 was just almost a total rewrite of KDE, wasn't it?
Correct, yeah. And, that, and part of that, from what I understand, is because Qt itself was a big change. You know, Qt 4 from Qt 3 was such a huge jump. I'm wondering, I mean, I know GNOME 3 is using Clutter a lot. Are there going to be big gaps in, like, you know, GTK 2 to GTK 3, or is there no GTK 3? This is just GNOME 3.
Yeah, I have no idea.
It's not going to create a big problem. GNOME, they're pretty conservative anyway, and they stated from the beginning that they want this to be a gradual and smooth transition.
Although it seems like their UI is changing really, really drastically. I mean, at least from these screenshots that I'm seeing.
Yeah, the UI change is pretty big, but yeah, they don't think that it's going to throw users nearly as bad as KDE.
Okay.
But with KDE, it wasn't just you. It was the applications made. They seemed to make, all the applications made that jump too, didn't they? Whereas this is still going to run a lot of the 2.28 applications. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, everything will pretty much work the same as they move across.
Yeah. Now, I know we discussed this too. I can't remember if it was on Linux Cranks or Tit, about this is going to use OpenGL to draw the windows and all that sort of stuff, isn't it? You're going to need a 3D capable card to run this, aren't you?
Yeah, the presenter at Ohio Linux Fest mentioned that they're trying to do a fallback to a non-accelerated Metacity, but I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Yeah, well, just looking at the performance, and once again, when I say this, this is still only is this beta? What would you even call this? This is nowhere ready for release yet. On the laptop, yeah, it ran really sad. So, I mean, obviously they might improve that. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't go and judge it on that alone.
So what, I mean, just from all the different screenshots I'm seeing, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. Is there a traditional desktop? I mean, everything that they're showing me has kind of weird interface and, like, stuff down the side. And I mean, is there, like, just a normal desktop?
Yeah, I don't know, Clark. That's what you're seeing in those screenshots is what I've got running. Every time you move up to that activities, you get all that menu stuff down the left-hand side.
Oh, okay, so this is... Well, that's the answer then, probably. So that's the activities, like, environment. But there is a traditional...
Yeah, that's right.
...desktop environment.
Yeah, once you move away from that, like, you might open an application or whatever, then all of a sudden that all disappears, and you're back to just your desktop. That has that menu bar at the top, menu bar at the bottom, and your whole workspace in front of you.
Gotcha.
Okay, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that whole overlay is... to try to get people to realize that they have multiple desktops.
Right.
I don't think many people actually use them.
Yeah, people see, like, all their applications disappear off their desktop or off their screen, you know, and they just don't understand what's happened.
And when you start it for the first time, you're only going to have one desktop until you click that little plus, and it starts adding more.
Oh, interesting. That's an interesting idea. I like that.
So maybe I'm wrong on this, but is this going to make Compiz, like, obsolete, or at least on GNOME?
Yeah, it sounds like they're integrating all that stuff into GNOME. They're kind of like merging with that project or whatever.
So once this comes out, the only window manager you can use Compiz on is probably XFCE.
Jay, Lindsay, you mentioned something about that when we talked before, didn't you?
They
more or less said, too bad.
Yeah, the Compiz guys were talking to the GNOME guys, and, well, it pretty much turned into, we don't see a future for the Compiz project.
Yeah, that's a bit sad. Well, they instigated more or less all this, didn't they, really?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, they're still going to probably be able to, I mean, their work was a lot of it was experimental anyway, and they just kind of threw out, or it seemed to me like they just threw out all these cool ideas for effects and stuff, and I mean, they can still do that, I'm sure. I mean, they can probably kind of work with GNOME, I would imagine, on effects. I mean, it seems to me like it's better to have it integrated than not. I could be wrong, but that's what it felt like to me back when I was using it more.
Yeah, and Compiz, it just looks kind of bad when things go wrong.
Yeah.
Like when you have your title bar disappearing or you have screen tearing or something like that.
Yeah.
So, Lindsay, something I didn't try. You mentioned before where you click the plus and, yeah, you get the extra workspaces, and I fill up 4 workspaces. And then you have that, when you go into that activities and you get the overview mode, then there's the minus superimposed in the center of each workspace. If you've got applications open, oh, that minus didn't show, did it? I was going to say, what happens if you click the minus and you have applications open on that workspace? Do they all disappear? But no, you can't see that minus if you've got something open. Don't worry about that question.
Hey, Monster B?
Yeah.
Looks like World of Goo is available for 64-bit in the default World of Goo setup .1.41.tar.gz. There's a binary for a 32 and for 64.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So did you go ahead and buy it?
Yeah, I went ahead and bought it, $20.
Can you download both of them?
You can download the tar.gz, the .deb, and the RPM all from the same screen. So that's what I did. I mean, I just figured I might as well because I wasn't sure what I was getting in each. But the tar.gz is probably realistically the one I'll probably use. And it's got everything that you need, it looks like. I mean, to play the game, not to rewrite it or anything, but, you know, it's got all the files.
That's pretty cool. Would you pay a penny?
Yeah, they wouldn't allow, like, the half-cent thing.
You went all the way out.
Yeah, I went to 1 cent because I couldn't talk them down. There was a flaw in their donation page. Wouldn't allow fraction values. No, I paid $20. That's what their suggested donation was.
Well, I'm going for 10.
Yeah, I'll just have to eat like SpaghettiOs for the next week. That's fine.
Well, is that it for your topic, Peter?
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to try it. I like KDE, and I doubt if anything can, you know, pull me away from KDE, but I do like the screenshots. I mean, I'll try it on the Triple E. It looks like a netbook screen to me.
That's what I keep thinking. Every time I see a screenshot, I'm like, is this on their netbook, or is this, like, the normal distribution? But now I understand it was the activity screen, I guess, that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I neither KDE or GNOME person, but I just like to play with all this stuff. And once again, it's a case of, you know, you never get a chance to get bored with it, like Windows.
Yeah.
There's always something new happening. We all know how to run additional accessions, you know. We can have, instead of having two open, now we go to three. We have Fluxbox, KDE, and GNOME running.
Well, I just can't wait till it's standard on Ubuntu.
When did I say 10? When did I say 10.04? I think without aiming for, wasn't it?
Really, it's that close?
Yeah, Fedora 13, Klaatu, I thought I read. When's Fedora 13 due out? They should be the two first distributions that release it as, you know, standard packages.
That's a year from now, isn't it?
Well, 10.04 must be April, isn't it?
Yeah,
April next year. Yeah.
I guess that's not that close. It feels close. It'll be right around the corner, you know. I mean, it's
when you're as old as Ads and me, that's just a couple of sleeps. Trust me. Time flies when you get to our age. Yes.
Well, Ads is still awake. Go ahead, Ads, with your story.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was surprised to find that Puppy Linux is still alive and well and in active development.
Love Puppy Linux.
The fellow that originally came up with the Puppy Linux, Barry Collar, he is back at the project now. He tried to retire, but his replacements found it was too much work, so he's back doing it himself. But while he was in hiatus from the project, he had time to play around with a system that he has named Woof, W-O-O-F, allows him to build the Puppy packages from any of the distros out there, whether it's Debian, Ubuntu, Arch, Slackware, you name it. And their new release, which is 4.3.1, it has a modern kernel in it, it's a 2.6.3.30.5 kernel. It's got the SMP kernel for it'll work for multiprocessors as well as the uniprocessors. Well, Puppy's always kind of moved to the beat of a different drum. Looks like they're coming along as far as maturing. Now, I don't know how much of that cut out or if I'm still on the air.
No, you're still on.
Yeah, and it didn't cut out.
Okay. Well, nobody was interrupting me. I couldn't tell.
We're too bloody scared because we know how big your chainsaw is. I did note that Puppy still includes, is it PPP for dial-up modems in there somewhere?
I'm pretty sure it does, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, that's
yeah,
pretty
rare. Yeah, they still support a dial-up modem, but they'll also support dial-up via 3G devices.
Oh, wow.
Now, I take it, I've never had anything to do with Puppy, but Puppy's, like, really good for, it's small. Like you can put it on a the disc used blokes always play around with, the little thumb drives, can't you?
Yeah, but the cool thing about it is it it feels like a normal, great little desktop. I put it on a friend's old IBM once, her ThinkPad, and I mean she was totally using it, loving it.
Yeah, the only thing I was thinking is, say you do a lot of traveling, I don't know about over there, but over here, a lot of the hotels and that don't offer Wi-Fi or wireless internet access. So if I was stuck in my hotel room, I could pull out my thumb drive, stick it in, I've got dial up there and on my laptop, and I could just use Puppy just to get on the internet. Too easy. Could have used this the other day.
Yeah, it is easy. One thing nice about Puppy is it will let you install it to a USB device. It, it only has a 100 megabyte download to start with, but you can install the whole system on a USB device, a USB key, and you can move it from computer to computer.
Too easy.
And they are supporting the EXT4 file system now too. So they are in active development, and they are keeping up. It looks like. They still kind of do things their own way, but nothing says that way is absolutely wrong. It just happens to be different. Well, that's all I got on it.
Well, it looks like their website's been updated too.
Yeah, it actually looks like a.
Yeah, well, you go over and on Barry's blog, he's actually already blogged tomorrow. Of course, he's in Australia, so that is tomorrow there today. But he's very active yet.
I just wish I had the time to try all these things out.
It'll be on a USB key here this weekend, and I'll tell you how it turned out.
Joe Lindsay, did you know that GNOME 3 has a built-in video desktop recorder?
I did not know that.
I knew something that you didn't. First time ever. All you got to do is hit, I think it's Alt-Control-Shift-R, and that'll start it, and you get a little red dot flashing.
Wow. That's very nice.
Yeah, it is.
That is cool. Yeah.
I haven't tried it. Yeah.
Try it. Watch it crash.
Don't be nasty. You've got to give a bit of GNOME love on this show occasionally.
No, I just know how those desktop recorders are, especially in alpha kind of software. I'd just get ready for the crash.
I must admit, I was going to boot into it to do this show, and I just thought better of it.
Yeah, right.
Is that it, Az, for that one?
Yeah, that's, it's short and sweet like Puppy.
All right. And let's move on to J-Man.
All right. I've been reading this magazine called Open Source, where the E is actually a 3.
You got off of that off of one of my picks for 1 week.
Do what?
You got that from one of my picks. That was one of my picks 1 week, I think, for either TID or Linux Cranks. Is that how you found out about that magazine?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Okay.
He doesn't listen to the show.
Oh, okay. Okay. Because I mentioned that magazine because it just recently, I mean, its first issue was like, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago now, and I had mentioned it, but please continue.
They focus on unified computing, which is basically this term for virtualization, networking, storage, pretty much anything that goes on in a data center. But it's very professional quality, it's advertisement supported. They have, lots of topics about the data center. They brought up this KAOS, which I've never even heard of until now. But apparently you just replace your kernel and you have a different system that's built off of KVM for virtualization. It's very professional, I think. And they do all their work with the GIMP and Scripus.
And that's issue 3, right, for KAOS?
Right.
The chaos thing, it's like a KVM optimized kernel or something, and then you pop that in and then you can run all your virtualizers off of that, or is that what it is, or is it something completely different?
Yeah, it's a hypervisor, but they use the KVM that's already in the kernel. I'm not sure what benefit there is.
That sounds cool. I'll have to look into that.
I'm going to have to download the magazine to find a link to that chaos. Doing a search, I can't find the website.
Wow, you're right. Be a super top secret project.
Yeah, apparently it's carbonmountain.com.
Is it really just a botnet or something?
Well, that's the link. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I see it. It is. He's right. Yeah, it looks very interesting. I mean, I don't understand much of it, but yeah, it's cool. I probably don't even have a CPU that can do all this stuff, but it does look neat. Am I right, Jay Lindsay, for KVM to really work, you have to have a CPU that has, like, a certain flag. Like, when you do a cat on the proc CPU info, there's a certain flag that you need to look for to see if it can actually do, like, KVM for real.
Right, you need to have at least VME support. VMX would be better.
Okay. Oh, okay, so you can technically do it with VME, as long as your kernel has all the KVM stuff compiled into it.
Right.
Cool, okay.
Anything else, J-Man?
Nope, that's it for me.
Cool, let's move on to 330.
I don't know how mine will be taken. I may be shot down like Pegwell was last time, but is anyone interested in hearing about the EFF bailing out a couple of guys who were hacking their TI calculators?
Not really.
Not really.
All right, well then continue on, gentlemen.
Nah.
We're just kidding. Let's hear it.
Don't be so touchy.
I wouldn't.
Jeez.
I found this... was posted on Boing Boing by my man crush, Cory Doctorow. Basically, some guys were writing their own software for the TI calculators, and because the calculators perform a signature check, which is a type of DRM, they somehow had violated the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and were being sued under the terms of the DMCA by TI, and the EFF came to their rescue and... they actually won the case, and TI had to leave them alone. I'm posting a link right now. So I just wondered everyone's thoughts on the legalities of reverse engineering and thoughts of how pissed they'd be if, you know, they were writing their own calculator software and were sued by TI for it.
Wouldn't it just be so much more constructive for TI to knock on their door and say, hey, cool, you're doing some really... interesting programming here, you know, what can we learn from what you're doing or something? I mean, they really have to waste their time on suing these people. I mean, give me a break. Either ignore them or leave them alone.
These are their best customers.
Yeah, exactly.
They really enjoy it.
Yeah, they like, yeah, it's ridiculous. It's crazy.
I mean, yeah, it is kind of a dick move to, you know, sue the hobbyists that also buy your product.
Yeah.
Because the thing was is you had to buy the hardware to be able to run the software that these guys were writing.
Yeah, so it's like a great advertisement for the hardware, if nothing else.
And therefore you legally own it.
How can we sue Linux Cranks listeners? Can we figure out some clause on how to start suing people for listening to our show?
If they're well...
Or if they have our show on their computer, you know, we could extort money from them somehow.
Okay, I got it. If they also listen to my show, they're getting sued.
Perfect. It's like some kind of conflict of interest or something.
We don't have to worry about that.
Three people.
That's true.
Yeah.
And all three of them are on this show right
that's
now.
That's a condition that's hard to meet.
And one of them is Pegwolf.
I don't listen to my own show.
That just means that, yeah, one of you listen because I download and then immediately delete it. So when we find the one listener, we're going to sue the shit out of you.
Right.
Yeah, Pete.
Just looking at this article, there seems to be a problem that calculators have to have a certain certification or something.
Well,
for some, it says here the big testing groups allow only certain certified calculator models, and that if these are one of the certified models and they're found to be easily hacked or whatever, they can end up being decertified, which I suppose could let... lose a lot of money for Texas Instruments or whoever this was. So maybe that could be why they're so worried about it.
Hey, but should it be an issue that is, you know, if nothing else, should it be the DMCA that people are taking the court over? I mean, couldn't just a simple violation of contract work? I mean, I think this is a gross misuse of the DMCA.
Isn't any use of the DMCA a gross misuse of the DMCA?
Well, no, I mean... yes, it's a shit law, but there are ways to use it that aren't as exploitative as others.
Yeah.
But, like, as it says in the story here, the DMCA specifically allows for reverse engineering to create interoperable custom software. And, yeah, I'm sure that TI knew it, and T.I.'s lawyers knew it, but you know, you take three or four college kids to court, they're all just going to pay up and shut up.
Right, yeah.
You know, but you get a great organization like the EFF, which, I full disclosure, I pay them money to be a member. But you get wonderful people like that coming to your aid, these cases turn around pretty quickly. I'm glad to see this didn't fall completely on its face like Pegwolves did.
I don't remember Pegwolves from last week. I have no memory of that.
That's how bad it was. There's something about wearing one shirt.
The see-through bloody looking through friggin' walls. I'll never forget that story.
Oh, that's right. That was pretty bad.
It could have been about having a lemon tuna mouth. That could have been the story.
That was really bad.
Get to the bin, 330, for even mentioning lemon tuna mouth on this show.
Yeah, I mean, that was like a shameless self-promotion or whatever that was.
In fact, I'm starting to think we should ban people even if they mention on Linux Cranks.
Works for me.
Well, then it, let it be written this day, the 18th day of the year 2009 of the Lord, or whatever they say. What do they say?
In this 2000
in the year of our Lord.
Year of our Lord.
Yeah, that'll do. Isn't that what I mean? I'm just
you're
not
an atheist. What do you care?
Yeah, thank God. I am.
What is a laugh track over there? Like, is that even real?
No, I just had me a good chuckle.
Oh, okay.
Somebody's tickling them. But, Pedro, go ahead, since 3:30's in the bin. It's your turn.
I don't have a story, remember?
Get to the
we
bin.
Put him into the bin.
Jeez. What are you even doing?
Put him in the bin, too.
Well, you come onto a show where, like, the point of it is to have a story, and you don't bring a story.
Nah, actually, don't pick on Pedro, because he's got a really good, cow.
I just come on to offer my opinions, and everyone can hear my lovely voice, and...
Oh, yeah, there is that.
You know.
Well, go ahead and give us your command of the week.
It is VNSTAT.
Let me actually pull it up here. When you first run it, it'll say no database found, nothing to do. Use, you know, --, help for help, of course. It'll say a new database can be created with the following command. VNSTAT --i whatever interface, like, you know, ETH0 or, you know, WLAN0, whatever. And you can also have it do it to where, instead of just, like, sampling how much information is going across that interface, you can have it just give you real-time output of how much bandwidth is going across that. Then, say, like, in an hour after you're done using it, you can just hit Control-C, and it'll give you a full output of all the bandwidth you've used in that hour.
Did you type that into IRC, and I'm just missing it?
I probably should.
Do that, because I keep trying it, and I'm not getting that command exists.
You'll probably have to.
You might have to install it.
Yeah.
I wanted this. When I was set up my Asterisk box, I wanted to see the throughput it could handle, how many people it could host on it. And I was trying to get some idea of what sort of bandwidth each person was using, and this is the thing that Pegwell told me to install on it. And it didn't come standard on Zeus or Arch or CentOS, so you probably have to install it, Klaatu.
Okay.
But it's really good. I used to use NetStat, I think it was.
That's what I was going to mention. Yeah, it sounds a lot like NetStat, but it's...
This is heaps better.
Cool.
Well, maybe not heaps better, but it's a lot easier to read.
Yeah.
Gave me exactly what I wanted to know, and then gave you the an overview at the end of it all, like your maximum throughput, your minimum, your average.
Cool.
And yeah, typically what people are going to need.
Is it its own program, or is it like some kind of shell script using NetStat on the back end? Because I mean, all that stuff I'm pretty sure can be gotten from NetStat. It's just you have to put about a dozen switches in to get to that point, unless I'm wrong.
No, you're probably right.
Sure.
You wouldn't know.
I'm pretty sure, yeah, because I mean, I used to have to use NetStat a lot at my old job, and I'm pretty sure we got all that. It sounds like we got all that information. I wonder if VNSTAT is just a more friendly way to use some of NetStat's features. Where did you find it, Pegwell? Do you remember? Was it just in the repo, or did you go to some website for it?
I forget why I installed it or what I was looking for, but I did find it in the repos.
Okay. I'm going to definitely look for that one. That sounds pretty nice.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that is pretty awesome.
I found the website. I'm going to paste it into IRC for you, Monster B.
I just installed it.
Oh, okay.
It says unable to write to database.
Yeah, you have to do the initialization thing, the dash u dash whatever.
Try running it as root.
Oh, okay. Harley says he just installed it using SBOPKG. Well, I mean, actually, I didn't even think to look in SBOPKG, so I guess that is good to know.
On the subject, Klaatu, your Bad Apples episode on Slackware was really good, and you're going to follow that up, aren't you, with SBOPKG on your next one?
Yeah, sure am.
Looking forward to.
Very much.
Not that I listen.
I know. I assume you're just going off of what you've heard in IRC or something.
Yeah. The word
you're like, oh,
street.
I'll mention that to Klaatu to make think that I listen to his show.
I ran into a fella in the main street of Bateman's Bay who was talking about the Bad Apple, so I stopped and listened to him.
Wow, cool. Yeah, I guess you tend to overhear conversations about the Bad Apples just in the most random places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Ha said you're the one who inspired him to use SBOPKG.
Awesome.
Someone should boot Har. I think he's a bit of a suck.
I know, me
sucking
too.
Sucking up the Klaatu.
Yeah.
We don't put up with that stuff.
Well, and Mac Machine B, he just said it was a good episode as well.
A little bit too much there.
Yeah.
He gets a reprieve because he's been hanging around long enough to see the error in his ways. But Har's, he's a noob. Boot him.
Yeah, let's get rid of him for sure.
That and, you know, everybody loves Snacky with his lumpy head.
Klaatu, why don't you go ahead and give your command of the week and drive these guys crazy?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they can handle it. No, actually, mine is nowhere near as cool as VN stat, but I was just, it's more of a command line flag of the week. Everyone obviously knows TAIL, right? T-A-I-L, the show that lasts by default 10 lines of a log file or a document or whatever. But the switch that I use a lot of times on TAIL is a dash F, which means that it's going to follow that document, meaning that basically if you do a tail dash F, you know, on let's say, now I can't think of a log file that I'd do this on, but on any given log file in a terminal window, then each time a new line is written to that log file, that pops up on your terminal window. So you're looking at that file, you know, in real time as it occurs. So when you're doing like network testing and stuff like that, or as much as I know about that sort of thing, you know, if you're like trying to see if you're getting data from someplace or something like that, you know, you can do a tail on a log file and see, you know, what kind of entries are being made to that log file. So it's actually quite handy for kind of monitoring what's happening on your system as maybe you're doing some other kind of test. That's tail-f, as in follow.
I've seen a plasmoid. I can't remember what. You've got a log file on TTY1, haven't you? Some file. If I flip over to TTY1 now, it'll be, a lot of information will be continually getting written to the terminal.
That is true, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I've seen a plasmoid that continually printed that out, so I'd imagine that's exactly what it was using.
It probably is. You're probably right.
Yeah, that's a good one to know, actually.
I used to use it a lot at my old job where we were, I forget exactly what I was doing. I think I was having to do testing to see if the Avahi or whatever, you know, the Avahi thing, you know, what was being picked up or something like that, or error messages. And I had to, like, tail-f all these different files to see what kind of error messages or confirmation of messages was being written out to the log file. And it really made the job a lot easier.
On my Debian box here, I have a command just called tail f, with, you know, without the dash.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it's a Debian thing. Let me look at the man page.
You mean it's tailf, or you mean it's you just type in
tailf?
Yes,
it's tailf.
It's probably like an alias, I'll bet. I don't know. Let me type.
Yeah, it's two in art, same thing, but it's probably two different commands, surely.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is a different command. I'm doing a man on it now.
But it's, no, actually, it does the same thing.
Yeah, it does the same thing.
Yeah, follow the graph of the log file. Yeah, there you go.
It says it's part of the util linux.ng package.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see. Yeah. Util.
It's similar to tail f, tail space dash f, but does not access the file when it is not growing. So I take it doesn't use any system resources. Is that what it means?
Yeah, probably. I'll bet you're right. I'll bet that's exactly. That sounds kind of nice. So it's almost like a daemon, or it goes to sleep until it makes that file ping it when that file changes, maybe.
This has the side effect of not updating the access time for the file. So if file system flush does not occur periodically when no log activity is happening, for all intensive purposes, I think for what we want it for, either one's going to work.
Cool. Well, I like tail better than tail-f then.
I like them both.
Okay.
I like the name TELF.
Well, you know, TELF, I'm sure I could get it somehow, but the Unix systems that I was using at this other job was not Linux, and so I don't believe it had TELF, especially since it was in util-linux-ng, I really doubt that it had TELF on it, so I had to use tail-f anyway.
So, Pegwall, you are no longer Pegwall, you are TELF now.
Look, I am one shirt V and stat Peggy.
Well, I guess we learned something today, huh?
I think we all learned a little something today.
Well, let's learn some more. How about you, Peter? What do you got for us?
XEV. Have you heard of that? Which is the X Event Viewer. And what that's going to do, if you run it, it's going to open up a little window, and in that window it's going to continually print out all the events that are happening in X. Now, typically, if you just run XEV, you're going to have your cursor over in that window. Then you might hit the keys on your keyboard, and it's going to print out a heap of data. If you start clicking the mouse, it's going to print out a heap of stuff as well. You can pass options to it, so it doesn't happen in that particular window. It happens in any window you want, I think. Now, what do you use it for? Good question. I typically use it. These days, a lot of remote controls, you don't need Lurk. You can just plug them in, they register as a USB keyboard and mouse. Then when you push buttons on them, you really don't know what signals it's sending. So what you can do is start up XEV and start hitting buttons on your remote, and you're going to see stuff like key press event, serial blah blah blah, synthetic blah blah blah, and you're going to get about 6 or 7 lines, but the line you're typically going to be interested in is going to say something like key code, and it'll give you a number. And it'll go key symbol, and that might be P if you're hitting the play button or the pause button. Typically, the remote might be sending the P. So it's one way of doing that. The other thing you can actually use this for, if you have a multimedia keyboard, and for some reason you have to have those keys going, but you don't know what they're doing, you can start this up and start hitting all those keys on your multimedia keyboard. Yeah. Probably going to get a key code, but you may not get any key symbol. What you have to do then is you've got to go and look up. There's only X amount of key symbols you can use, I think, but that to actually get in and tell you how. You're going to have to also modify your Xmod map file, I think, is the other thing you've got to do, but I can't get into all that now. But if you're interested in doing that sort of stuff, do a Google for XEV, Xmod map, and that should get you started in that. So there you go. Oh, just one more. I'm going to set myself in the bin here because I heard Dan talking about trying to see if his remote was working the other day. They were using IRW, but IRW will only work if you have Lurk configured correctly. The simplest one to do is use Hexdump. Has anyone used that before? Joe Lindsay, have you ever heard of that? Where you just do a Hexdump space dash C, then space, then the device. And for a remote, your device might be dash dev dash remote. Start pushing buttons and it'll dump all the hexadecimal output to the terminal, and at least you know then your remote's working. And you don't need Lurk or set up to do that. So there you go.
So do you actually use Xmod map really frequently?
Glad to. I've never used it.
Oh,
never.
Okay.
No, I typically use XEV for the remotes. I muck around a hell of a lot with remote controls. So that's where I've come across it and used it. But XEV, if you want your... Just do a Google for XEV. It can be used for a hell of a lot more than that. It's showing every... It's not just keyboards. It's showing everything that's happening in your X session. when you move a mouse, you'll see a heap of data go across the screen. I think when you highlight windows, you know, you bring them to the forefront and background and all that, it's telling you everything. But unfortunately, I don't need to know any of that shit because I wouldn't know what to do with it all.
Yeah, I've used XEV and I've never known really what to do with it, but that's interesting to hear what you actually do use it for. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Jesse James has just done his output there, the XMOD map. And that, see where it goes, key code 178 equals. Okay, that's the key code that you'll find in that XEvent viewer. So then you can associate it and see he's got there the XF86 audio raised volume. I'll put a link that I've got. And these lists, Monster Bean, you might put in the show notes, these are the only things you can use. The symbols or the whatever you call them, the references that X will understand.
You done with yours?
Yeah.
All right, very cool, Peter. Now let's move on to Azimuth.
Well, I want to revisit the screen command since we had a discussion about this week. Somebody who I was sure knew all about screen turned out knew nothing. And so I got to thinking, well maybe there's a lot of people that don't know about screen.
Who was that, J-Man?
I wouldn't know, but it starts with M and ends with B.
No idea.
You fill in the rest. Yeah, I don't either. But... Screen is a Windows manager. It's not a GUI Windows manager. You don't even have to have Xorg installed or X on the machine, but you can use just the Screen Windows manager and have multiple terminals without logging into every terminal you open. You just log into one terminal and you keep opening different windows for it and add what you need. There's some very basic commands is really all anybody pretty much needs on it, but it has a quite complete set of issues with it, and it will do amazing things if you read the well here. Let me paste the there's the manual for it. You read that and you will find things that Screen will do that none of us may ever use, but you should know at least the basic commands on it. The most basic one is the screen dash ls or screen dash list, which you just do from the terminal, and it will tell you if you have a screen session running. And detach that screen from wherever it is running with the dash capital D command it's not the command, it's actually a switch on the screen command. It will detach that screen from any place that it is connected, and you can add the R command or R switch to it, and it will reattach to the terminal that you have open, so whatever screen you have running, you can open it right there. Now, there's also a dash XR command, which will allow any screens that are running to still be running, but it will reattach them to the terminal you are in, and that will allow multiple terminals on the same screen session, which is what I myself do a lot with ARISI. I run ARISI in a screen, and I attach to it with computers all over the place here, and never disconnect from it. It's the screen session is always sitting there running, and ARISI's running, and I can pick up any computer on my LAN and jump right into the IRC right where I left off, and most of the time nobody even knows that I've moved from one computer to another. But the beauty of screen is that not only for things that you're actually running, but you can open a screen window with the Control A, C, and that will open a new screen window, and in that screen window you can run another program. And it's completely independent. Whatever you have running in the first screen, it's just like any window manager. You know, that's off running by itself, and what you're running in this window is running by itself. In fact, I even have the Lisa bot from the IRC is running in a screen window all the time, which is it's really convenient to get over if the bot screws up. I can just jump in, do a control C in that window, and stop the bot and restart it, and it goes on about its merry business, connects back up again. You know, I'll be running along there, you know, this all SSH'd into my server, and so I may have one window that's open into as a super user to where I can do, you know, root stuff over there. And but it's sitting there running independent of what's running in the other windows, and it is a Windows manager, but it is a text-based Windows manager as opposed to Black Box or Fluxbox or OpenBox or anything else that would require X.
Yeah, you can split the screen horizontal and vertical, have different sessions going on in different. On the different splits. It's a great program. I love Screen.
Yeah, anybody that hasn't played with it, they need to go play with it and just go through the manual that I listed there and just try the different switches in it and watch it go crazy. Because you'll find things that it does that you just shake your head and say, well, wait a minute. I don't even need to have X running. I've got some machines that it's kind of flaky getting X up and running on, but gosh, you put Screen in them, and you've got all the advantages of a window manager without the graphical problems that you end up with on some of these display cards.
Yeah, you're not exaggerating. It'll change the way that you use your text console. That's for sure.
And it's one of those things, the more you learn about it, the more you find out that you never imagined it would do.
That's just like today. I was on my desktop, you know, connected to my free BSD box with Screen in the chat room. I detached, took my EEE to the coffee shop today, and then connected to my free BSD box again, reattached, and nobody knew it. And I could look over and see what was said in the chat room. I never missed anything.
Yeah, that's cool.
Well, other than we just thought you was rude because you were ignoring us, but that's a different story altogether.
Yeah, see, I was on my way to the coffee shop when you guys were talking to me. But it's very handy.
Is it? Do you know if it's really easy to change the default, either the key binding, like, the, you know, because it's Control A and then whatever letter, to change it away from Control? Is it just a simple config file somewhere, or do you know, or if it's...
Yeah, there's a ScreenRC file, .ScreenRC file that you need to go look at, and you can set up your key bindings in it.
Cool. Some of those Control key bindings kind of override some of the default Bash key bindings, and I always found that kind of annoying, but other than that, I love it.
Well, spend some time digging through the manual on it, and especially after you've been using it for a while, and all of a sudden you see things that, I wondered why it did that, and that's how I can get past, you know, some little idiosyncrasy that you thought it had, and it was all, well, it turns out it was your operation of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you only need Screen on the one box you're connecting to.
Yeah. Of course, I've been finding Screen comes stock in a lot of distros anymore.
Yeah, I don't remember the last time I had to actually install it.
Only one I run it on is my server. About everything else has got a GUI around here. Another one what?
Another, like, Screen-type application. I thought it was, like, called, like, Tux Window Manager. It's, like, very similar.
I think I've heard of the
Maybe,
one
I haven't.
But I don't think it's called Tux Window Manager, though. Unless there is one called that, but I think I know what you're talking about. But I heard Screen was quote unquote better. I don't know why. They just said use Screen.
think you're thinking about TMUX.
Yeah. How do you spell that? It's
TMUX.
Yep, that's it. Now, can you... Well, never mind. I was going to ask you about the colors, but that depends on whatever terminal you're using, right?
Yeah, if you have your terminal set to Linux colors or whatever, then that'll be used. And then if it's a text console, I guess it just whatever settings you've got for your for that.
Well, too, now screen sets there and runs until you actually close it. And if you detach from a screen session, the screen session is still sitting there running, where you can come back in and reattach to it either from the computer that it's running on or you can SSH into it. And you can go right back to the session that's just been sitting there idling along doing its own thing, even though it had no terminal connected to it.
Yep, it is an amazing application. Perfect. We're out of time. Anything else on this one before I end the show?
Nope.
All right. You can send us feedback at feedback@titradio.info. And remember to visit titradio.info for the AUG feed and show notes. And I'm going to say another tit is in the can. Good night, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.
boom, an explosion happened between my legs.